Julie Otsuka, The Buddha in the Attic, 2011. Some of us on the boat were from Kyoto and were delicate and fair and had lived our entire lives in darkened rooms at the back of the house. Some of us were from Nara and prayed to our ancestors three times a day and swore we could still hear the temple bells ringing. Some of us were farmers' daughters from Yamaguchi, with thick wrists and broad shoulders, who had never gone to bed after 9. This passage may give a clue as to how Julie Otsuka's book is to be read. She calls it a novel. It is closely and carefully based on factual histories. There are novelistically vivid faces, scenes, glimpses, voices, each for a moment only. So you cannot linger anywhere or with anyone. Information is given, a good deal of it, in the most gracefully invisible manner, and history is told. Yet the book has neither a novel's immediacy of individual experience nor the broad overview of history. The tone is often incantatory, and though the language is direct, unconvoluted, almost without metaphor, its true and very unusual merit lies, I think, in that indefinable quality we call poetry. Writing a long narrative in the first person plural is a risky business. It brings up questions that don't come to mind with the familiar first or third person singular. For one thing, the reader identifies easily with an I narrator or a he-she protagonist. And though some critics sneer at sympathetic identification and some novelists delight in frustrating it, it remains a fundamental element of the pleasure of story. But it's hard to identify strongly with a whole group, even if one is interested in it as a group, and even if its members are individually sympathetic. And we sets up two groups, we and they slash you. Some languages make the distinction between the inclusive we, meaning I and all of you, and the restrictive I and others, not including you. The we of the Buddha in the Attic is an artificial literary construct that does not include an I. The group supposed to be speaking are Japanese picture brides of the early 20th century. Women married by proxy to Japanese men working in the United States were shipped across the Pacific to husbands whom they had seen, and who had seen them, only in a photograph. The arrangement was made for men who had no other way to get a wife, and for women, mostly young and very poor, who hoped for a better life in Golden California. The practice was continued for some decades. The group in the novel appears to have come over shortly after the First World War. The picture brides had no way to know that American racial prejudice would isolate them with their husbands, and that for the rest of their lives they would be we only to one another, we the Japanese in America. To white Americans they would always be them. That is Otsuka's justification for telling the story in an unusual and difficult way. And it is a powerful one, and effective. It makes the point without stating the point. On the ship, traveling in steerage, the women really do form a group, however disparate. When they get to the promised land, they are scattered, each to her husband, and the husbands are emphatically they, not we. That night, our new husbands took us quickly. They took us calmly. They took us gently, but firmly, and without saying a word. They took us flat on our backs on the bare floor of the Minute Motel. They took us before we were ready, and the bleeding did not stop for 3 days. Later, as they go on with their hard, poor lives, slaving at stoop labor in the fields of California, working in the kitchens of the labor camps or of middle-class employers, the absolute otherness of the whites still doesn't join them with their husbands. Even when their children are born, though at first they are very close, always, heartbreakingly, they too are not us. In early summer, in Stockton, We left them in nearby gullies while we dug up and sacked onions and began picking the first plums. We gave them sticks to play with in our absence and called out to them from time to time to let them know we were still there. Don't bother the dogs. Don't touch the bees. And at the end of the day, when there was no more light in the sky, we woke them up from wherever it was they lay sleeping and brushed the dirt from their hair. It's time to go home. Before long, as the children grow taller than their fathers and forget their Japanese and will speak only English, as they eat hugely, drink milk, dump ketchup on potatoes, become ashamed of their parents and will not bow to them, the gap widens. With each passing day, they seem to slip further and further from our grasp. The children are joining the others, the white Americans. But then comes the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Otsuka tells of the months of increasing hostility and suspicion the Japanese Americans lived through, their fear, their incredulity, before they were summarily dispossessed and deported to detention camps as enemy aliens. In its agonized poignancy and restraint, this may be the finest passage of the book. I am sorry that after it, in the last chapter, she suddenly changes her narrative mode, ceases to follow her group of women. The point of view changes radically, and suddenly we are the whites. The Japanese have disappeared from our town. I was 12 when the Japanese disappeared from my town, Berkeley. My unawareness, my incomprehension of the event at the time, has troubled and informed my mind for many years. It's up to me, as a white American, to deal with that ignorance and denial. Julie Otsuka can't do it for me. I can only wish she had gone all the way with her heroines into the exile from exile, to those bitter desert and mountain prison towns, where few of us went even in imagination, until those who returned began to bear witness.